This is the story of the one. As a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility, he knows keeping the line up and running is a top priority. That's why he chooses Grainger. Because when a drive belt gets damaged, Grainger makes it easy to find the exact specs for the replacement product he needs. And next day delivery helps ensure he'll have everything in place and running like clockwork. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you've been thinking about getting serious with your money, like actually serious, now's the time. The Motley Fool is offering new members 50% off their iconic stock recommendation service, Stock Advisor. This is the same service that's crushed the market with recommendations that have returned 1,057% since inception, compared to the S&P 500's 180% over that same period. This isn't guesswork. The Motley Fool has a track record of finding companies before they become household names. So if you want to invest smarter and you like saving money while doing it, go to fool.com/listen to claim your 50% off discount off a one-year term of Stock Advisor. Again, that's fool.com/listen. Returns of 1,057% are from the Motley Fool's product Stock Advisor and measured against S&P 500 returns of 180% as of July 10th, 2025. Past performance is not an indicator of future results. All investing involves a risk of loss. Individual investment results may vary.
Hey everyone, I'm Sam.
And I'm Sean.
And this is Key to the Case. Welcome back. Thank you all for tuning in today. We have to give a big thank you to our listener, Mala, for bringing today's case to our attention. There were a lot of good sources in this case, some really good reporting from the Examiner, but one that was particularly helpful was a book written about the case called Tasmania's Beaumaris Beach Mystery, What Happened to Nancy and Victoria by Melanie Calvert. This is also the first time we're covering a case outside of the U.S. in a while, so let's get into it. Nancy Grunewald was 26 years old at the time of her disappearance in 1993. Nancy was born in the northernmost city in Germany, Flensburg, near the border of Denmark. Nancy, alongside her younger sister, was raised in a religious household, a foundation that deeply influenced her and carried into adulthood. It was clear through my research that Christianity and Nancy's faith was an important part of her life. Nancy's described as having an energetic, sunny, and carefree personality, and she was very sensible and mature. She also loved to laugh and to make others laugh as often as she could. Nancy played several instruments, including the guitar, piano, and the harmonica. At the age of 20, Nancy became a travel agent, and this was a fitting role considering she loved to travel herself. At the time of her disappearance, she'd visited 14 different countries, including a trip to Australia, where she would ultimately disappear from. Fluent in German, French, and English, Nancy navigated various countries with ease. She also frequently traveled alone, and as I read about Nancy, the adjectives that kept coming to mind were competent and capable. I know Nancy was an adult, but it didn't seem her parents really had any reason to be worried about her international travels. As far as everyone in Nancy's life was aware, she was single at the time of her disappearance, but she certainly had a lot of close friends in her life. Now, we need to walk through the timeline of the events leading up to Nancy's disappearance. I'm going to throw a lot of dates out and locations, but you just need to understand that these are Nancy's movements before she disappeared, and the individual dates aren't all that significant on their own. In July 1992, Nancy departed Germany and traveled to New Zealand, where she enrolled in a Bible college in Auckland. Nancy's plan was to stay in New Zealand while she took courses at the Bible college for roughly 8 months. After she completed her coursework, she stayed in New Zealand, and she welcomed her mom and dad for a visit between early February until early March 1993. So she had been there for about 7 months when they came to visit, and they stayed for about a month. Nancy's parents had a nice time visiting her and exploring the area, and it was evident that Nancy had been enjoying her time in New Zealand. Nancy's parents left on March 2nd, and they had no idea that would be the last time they ever saw their daughter. After Nancy's parents returned to Germany, she remained in New Zealand for just a few days until March 6th, at which point she flew from Auckland to Melbourne, Australia. Nancy intended to travel around Australia for somewhere between 2 and 3 months. She had a few different friends to visit, including one in Hobart, Tasmania. And Tasmania will be central in this case. And our listener who shared Nancy's case with us gave us some helpful information about Tasmania. She described it as a small island state of Australia known for its beautiful mountain ranges and just kind of as having a beautiful environment overall. So it's not hard to see why Nancy wanted to visit there. And it's possible she may have even visited if she didn't have a friend there.
I suppose I'm wondering how she was able to do this. Like, she's already been gone for, would you say, 8 months, something like that. And now she's planning on traveling for another 2 to 3 months. So I'm guessing she just saved up a bunch of money from working and now she's able to travel for just under a year.
Yeah. So I think you're right. She had saved up for this and kind of tell by how much money she had in her bank account, but she was also making this kind of a cost-friendly trip. She was being pretty frugal and she was staying with friends when she could, but she was staying in a lot of hostels as well. So she wasn't going all out on this trip or anything. So I think she was able to do it. And you're right. If something hadn't happened to her, it would have been about a year that she stayed away.
Okay, that makes sense.
On March 6th, Nancy took a flight from Melbourne to Devonport, Tasmania, where she stayed in a hostel for 3 nights. On March 8th, Nancy purchased a one-way ferry ticket from Devonport to Melbourne for April 4th, almost 4 weeks later. But Nancy would never make that trip. Also on March 8th, Nancy went to a bank in Devonport where she exchanged $6,000 of New Zealand currency for Australian currency, which amounted to about $4,500. So kind of where I was going with that, she had probably enough to last her the rest of her trip, the remaining 2 or 3 months. She kept $300 in cash at that time, and she requested a new card be sent to that bank at a branch in Hobart, which she would pick up in about a week. Recall, she was going to visit a friend in Hobart, and Hobart is about 280 kilometers or 175 miles from Devonport. The following day, on Tuesday, March 9th, Nancy rented a red Road Chief Marauder mountain bike in Devonport. Nancy told the bike hire service that she planned to return the bike on March 22nd. So that was about 2 weeks later. And she also left behind a backpack of items that she would be unable to transport with her. She intended to retrieve those items at the same time as returning the bike. And she told the employee at the bike service that she didn't have set plans. So she asked if she could possibly return the bike on a bus if she decided to not return to Devonport. And she also asked if he could send her backpack wherever she ended up.
So what were her plans between March 22nd when she was going to return the bike and April 4th? When she booked that ferry ride. So that's a pretty large gap in time.
Yeah. So no one knows what Nancy's plans were between those 2 dates, but I don't think Nancy even had set plans based on what she told the employee at the bike hire service. It seemed like during this whole trip, she was just kind of going with the flow, and it seemed like that's how she intended it to be. I don't think she wanted to be bound by very specific plans throughout the whole trip. She did want to visit Adelaide, South Australia, though, to meet with a reverend, and that likely would have happened very shortly after April 4th. So she rented the bike on March 9th, but investigators were unable to establish how Nancy spent the rest of the day, nor could they establish where she slept that night. However, they determined that she spent the following night of March 10th at the Backpackers Hostel in Launceston. And the presumption is that Nancy traveled by bike from Devonport to the Backpackers Hostel. When you put this route in Google Maps, the estimated length of time it would take to travel by bike is between 5 and 6 hours. And the total distance is about 100 kilometers or 62 miles. The idea here is that she's trying to get to Hobart, right? And Launceston looks slightly out of the way when looking at the most direct route from Devonport to Hobart, but it's not like completely in the opposite direction or anything. It also didn't appear she was in a big rush, so she had time to spare.
Yeah, depending on her situation and really what she had going on, 60 miles isn't that crazy to do in a day. You could do that in a few hours, or you could take all day if she's going at a leisurely pace.
Yeah, I'd be taking a lot of breaks, I think, if I were traveling 60 miles in one day. But that's the point, right? I think she could go at a leisurely pace. And, you know, we don't know where she spent the night before, but I don't think it matters that much once we find out kind of what happened to Nancy. Well, we don't know what happened to Nancy, but I mean the timeline in which it happened. So there's kind of that one night where we're not really sure where she stayed, but then the next day she made it to Launceston and stayed at that hostel. The next day, Thursday, March 11th, Nancy withdrew $200 from a bank account and departed Launceston to go to St. Helens on a bus. It's presumed that she took the bike with her on the bus. St. Helens is located on the northeast coast of Tasmania off the Tasman Highway. St. Helens looks out of the way too a little bit, but it's possible she wanted to ride her bike along the coast to Hobart to see her friends because Nancy was known to enjoy spending time in coastal areas as opposed to more inland areas. Also on March 11th, Nancy spoke with her parents on the phone for the last time. She told them she was doing okay and that she was going to visit her friend in Hobart. Nancy stayed at a hostel in St. Helens, and the following day, Friday, March 12th, 1993, Nancy departed the hostel between 9:30 and 10:30 a.m. on her bike. She headed south, riding through Beaumaris, where she likely stopped to walk on Beaumaris Beach and reportedly purchased a soft drink from a nearby motel and read a book on the beach before she continued on her bike ride. We know this because of witness sightings of her. The very last confirmed sighting of Nancy was around 11 a.m. on her bike, about 5 kilometers or a little over 3 miles south of Scamander on Tasman Highway. Two fellow tourists who stayed at the same hostel were the ones who spotted Nancy on her bike while they were traveling on the highway by car. They indicated that although they didn't stop to speak to Nancy, they recognized her and she stood out as she was the only person traveling by bike. I think the fact that these people met Nancy the day before, they recognized not just her, but her bike, helps to lend credibility to this sighting. And it really is considered the last credible sighting of Nancy. Nancy never made it to see her friend in Hobart. More than a month went by before Nancy was reported as a missing person. And anyone who follows true crime knows that time is of the essence in these cases, making it troubling that her absence went unreported for weeks.
So I thought she was supposed to see her friend, like she was on the way to see her friend, and it's been a month and she gets reported missing. So who reported her missing and was it her friend?
It was not her friend. Ultimately, it was the Reverend she was supposed to meet in Adelaide after her time in Tasmania who reported Nancy as missing. So he was concerned when Nancy never appeared. So on April 15th, 1993, he reported her as a missing person to the police in Victoria. So she was last seen on March 12th, and it's by, you know, April 15th that someone's finally reporting her as missing, but not even to the right agency. And I don't blame him for reporting it to the police in Victoria. He didn't know where Nancy was, but The police in Victoria then determined that Nancy was last known to be in Tasmania. So the Tasmanian police were informed of Nancy's disappearance. And the investigation commenced on April 19th. So that friend of Nancy's who you're asking about, who lived in Hobart, did not report Nancy's absence, most likely because she assumed Nancy made other plans or simply couldn't make it anymore. And Nancy's family didn't report her as missing either. I think everyone just kind of assumed that she was busy. You know, this is a time before cell phones. They couldn't just easily get a hold of her. So I don't think anyone assumed the worst. The first order was to disseminate the news of Nancy's disappearance through the media to elicit information from people who may have crossed paths with Nancy during her time in Tasmania. Nancy's family traveled to Tasmania and publicly pleaded for information. With that, they received a large number of tips and sightings, including that final sighting of her that I told you about. This information helped them establish the timeline we have walked through, but it also narrowed the physical location of the investigation to the east coast of Tasmania and the area between St. Helens and Bishanoe. So those are kind of where the sightings were of her. And St. Helens was where she spent her night or her last night in Tasmania before completely vanishing. Once they learned of the final sighting of Nancy riding her bike on Tasman Highway, that area became a focus as well. They also reviewed Nancy's bank records and established that there was absolutely no activity beyond March 11th. If police wondered if Nancy had taken off on her own, I think the lack of bank activity would make that possibility less likely. We know she had some cash, but not necessarily enough where you would expect she could stretch it over the duration since she was last seen more than a month prior. So several thousand dollars remained untouched in her bank account. On May 14th, more than 2 months since Nancy was last seen, the commissioner of Tasmania Police advised the investigation into Nancy's disappearance be upgraded to a major crime investigation and the responsibility of the investigation transferred to the Northern Police District. A large number of interviews were conducted with potential witnesses and people who encountered Nancy, but little information was provided to develop a suspect or person of interest. There was no one in Nancy's life who surfaced who wanted to hurt her.
She's also traveling, so it's not like she was able to make a lot of enemies, right? While she was traveling.
Right. And even if she had any in Germany where she was from, those people weren't there with her, at least as far as we know. So when looking at Nancy's life, they just didn't come upon anyone who even made sense as a suspect. Extensive physical searches for Nancy began early on in the investigation. The highest priority was to find Nancy, but if they couldn't find Nancy, maybe they could at least find her bike or some of her belongings, which could lead them to her. The area of the last confirmed sighting of Nancy is described as unpopulated, with it being a semi-farming or forest area. More than 30 days were dedicated to searching for Nancy in the initial investigation. Road searches were completed on the Tasman Highway that began in St. Helens and continued for a distance of about 119 kilometers or 74 miles. And they searched 50 meters or 164 feet out from the road on either side, but they were often challenged by dense vegetation. Aerial searches by helicopter were conducted as well. Police divers searched water sources in the area. And of course, there were expansive land searches, not only in the area where Nancy was last seen, but also in areas extending out from there and in areas where the police received tips from people who believe they may have seen Nancy. Despite their efforts, Nancy was never located, nor was her bike or any of her personal belongings, and that remains the case today.
So I have a couple questions. Could she have gotten to her destination and then gotten abducted rather than on the way? And my second question is, were there any other similar crimes that happened of young women traveling alone, getting abducted in that general vicinity?
Or just disappearing.
Or just disappearing, yeah.
I'll start with your second question. So I am going to tell you about one other case. It's a murder, actually, a little bit later on. But no, there were not other disappearances occurring at this time in Tasmania. There was nothing similar to this. So yeah, Nancy's disappearance kind of stood out on its own, and it was frightening to people. And to your first question, there's no evidence that she made it to Hobart. I mean, we don't know what happened to Nancy, so I suppose it can't be ruled out. But the distance from where she was last seen to Hobart would be about 234 kilometers or 145 miles. So that would be quite a distance to make in one day. I think it seems really unlikely that she would have made that in one day. And there's no history of where she stayed Friday night. So it seems more likely that she wasn't able to make it anywhere on Friday beyond a certain point. And all the sightings that were coming were all kind of in a certain area and didn't go beyond Bishnoe, I think. So there was no reason to believe that Nancy ever made it to Hobart. In 2003, 10 years after Nancy disappeared, a coroner's inquest into Nancy's disappearance occurred. And a coroner's inquest is an inquisitorial process concerning the death or suspected death of a person led by the coroner, in this case, Peter Wilson. The coroner reviews the facts of the case and may even call witnesses. If the coroner establishes that they believe a missing person is deceased, they will work to establish the cause and circumstances around the person's death. The coronial report is available to view online, and in this case, it was a valuable resource, and much of the information we've discussed thus far is summarized in the report. Peter Wilson concluded through his review of the investigation that Nancy is deceased. Further, he believes she died as a result of foul play in Tasmania, either on the day she was last seen or very shortly after that date.
What was his conclusion based on?
So we don't have access to all of the files that he had access to, right? The police reports, the detailed outline of the investigation. We don't have that. There could be a lot guiding his decision that we don't know about. But I also think there's just a complete lack of evidence that Nancy is still alive. So I think it makes sense to come to the conclusion that Nancy's deceased and what happened to her most likely happened when she was last seen or shortly thereafter.
Right. Yeah, I suppose it makes sense. But there's also a lack of evidence that she isn't still alive.
Yes, I think that's true. But I think it would be harder to find the evidence that she's dead than it would be to find the evidence that she's alive.
I guess.
Does that make sense?
Really, the only scenario in which she's still alive is that, I don't know, I guess if she completely abandoned her life and started a new one and got a new identity and everything, or she was just captured, right?
I suppose. I mean, starting a new life seems really strange because even if you think about it, she had that bank card sent to a bank in Hobart. So that was showing kind of intention to at least make it to Hobart, and she never picked up that new card. So that's just one detail, but yeah, there's just no evidence to support that she was still alive. And I know there's not evidence that she's dead, but the evidence that not being able to find any sign of life almost seems like an indicator that she isn't alive. Wilson indicated that the delay and notice of Nancy's disappearance negatively impacted the investigation and clouded memories of possible witnesses. Suspects were identified during the police investigation as a result of tips received from the public, known or rumored behavior, prior convictions, and/or inconsistent or inappropriate statements made to the police or to other people. But nothing of substance was developed, and to date, no suspects have been named. Wilson outlined a list of possible scenarios that could have resulted in Nancy's death. And we will talk through all of them, but I want to start with one scenario that involves a motorist striking Nancy while on her bike and either collecting her belongings and her body to dispose of elsewhere or knocking her off the road and out of view. And we've talked about this in other cases. I think it was even in our last episode, Alexis Dillard, we talked about that possibility. In his case, we didn't think it was that likely, but in this case, I think there's reason to believe it's a possibility. And Wilson considers the first possibility as unlikely, the one where Nancy was on her bike, a motorist struck her, and someone collected her belongings and her body to dispose of elsewhere. But he acknowledged that it can't be discounted. Wilson also considers the second scenario as unlikely, the one where she's just knocked out of view due to the extensive searches for Nancy. It's unlikely she wouldn't have been found.
So were the lanes that she was riding her bike on, presumably, were they wide enough to where, or I guess not even wide enough, was there like a designated bike lane where cyclists ride on to not interfere with traffic? Or was it the situation where she was just riding in the main traffic lane? Because if there was a designated bike lane, obviously there would be way less of a chance that she could get struck by a car. But if she was riding in just a normal traffic lane, then yeah, that likelihood increases a lot.
So I, of course, have never driven on the road, Tasman Highway, that Nancy drove on. But I did look at a lot of different points of where I think she would have been riding her bike on Google Street View. And I tried to look around, get a sense of exactly your question. Like, would it make sense that someone could have accidentally hit her? And I didn't really see a bike lane for much of the route. There were points where there's more of a shoulder that she could have been riding on, but it still seemed conceivable that someone could have hit her. Now, what I will say about this area is it was pretty flat. So in a scenario where someone did hit Nancy, it's not like she would go tumbling down a hill or a cliff or anything of that nature. So it almost seems more likely that if this is what happened, the person then got Nancy and her bike and everything and put it in their car with them. But there's also the possibility that Nancy took an alternative route, and we will come back to that in a moment. And also keep in mind, you kind of have to take a little small grain of salt just because I'm looking at imaging from more recent years. This occurred in 1993. I don't know how much the roads have changed since then, if much at all, but typically the oldest imaging I could find was kind of around 2008. So still many years after Nancy's disappearance. So the coroner kind of ruled the two incidents that involve a motorist striking Nancy as being unlikely. He didn't discount them, but not everyone agrees with Wilson's findings. In fact, one person in particular has been vocal about his theory regarding Nancy's presumed death. In 2011, 8 years after the inquest and 18 years after Nancy vanished, a retired detective sergeant who spent 35 years with the Tasmania Police and who was a lead investigator in Nancy's case at one point, named Bob Code, spoke publicly about the case. He claimed that there was vital information not considered in the 2003 inquest. Code claimed that around the time of Nancy's disappearance in 1993, a solicitor or lawyer checked his answering machine in his office in Hobart on a Saturday morning. The solicitor recalled the voice of a distraught man who claimed he was driving on the east coast of Tasmania when he struck a cyclist. He repeatedly stated that it was a terrible accident and that he needed help. The lawyer searched for news regarding a cyclist vehicle accident in the days after he received the message, and when he saw nothing of the sort and the person never called back, he kind of brushed it off as nothing and he didn't report it. It was several months after Nancy's disappearance became public that the lawyer came forward to the police. When detectives visited the lawyer after he contacted them, the message was long gone, having been recorded over many times. The only account we have about this voicemail is from the lawyer himself. And it's hard to know how much weight to put into this alleged voicemail, and there are many questions. Why did the lawyer wait until months after Nancy's disappearance became public to say something? Is it possible he forgot about the voicemail until something triggered his memory, or did he not hear about it until then? Or maybe he just didn't make the connection until then. What seems like a rather jarring and concerning voicemail to us may not have been that to him. We don't know what kind of calls he was getting on a regular basis.
So why call anyone? Why, if you think you just did this, why call a random lawyer that you don't know? Why not at least call the police?
Well, I think the reason for not calling the police would be the person doesn't want to be caught. They don't want to take accountability, but maybe they called the lawyer just to prepare for the event that they did get caught. Or maybe they just wanted to get it off their chest to someone who isn't going to report them. They don't even know who they are. The person kept saying it was a terrible accident and it sounded like they felt bad. They were super distraught. So clearly they were really shaken up about this. So maybe they wanted to tell someone. I don't know. With the lawyer waiting so long, I just think it's hard to work with, right? And again, we don't know if the lawyer just didn't think about it until he thought about it, or maybe he didn't make that connection.
Yeah, there's really no confidentiality aspect between this guy and the lawyer at this point, because he's not the lawyer's
client
yet. Yeah, right.
No, but the lawyer didn't even know who he was, so he wouldn't know, you know, like who to report to the police.
Yeah, I mean, he had the phone number. They could probably trace the phone number to someone.
Maybe. But then if the person were that paranoid, they probably called from a payphone or somewhere where you wouldn't easily trace them.
Yeah. Yeah, true.
So there's that phone call, right? I keep saying phone call. It's the voicemail that someone left. Then in July 1997, 4 years after Nancy disappeared, Australia's Most Wanted covered Nancy's case. During the program, they asked viewers to call Crime Stoppers if they had relevant information about the cases being discussed. Bob Code shared with the media that shortly after the program aired, a man with a Brisbane number called Queensland Crime Stoppers to report that he accidentally struck a cyclist on the east coast of Tasmania while driving around the time of Nancy's disappearance. The caller was very distressed while reporting this information, and he chose to stay anonymous. He admitted to pushing the body off the pass, and then he allegedly continued on to Hobart. Soon after, he left Tasmania by boat from Devonport, presumably eventually making his way back to Brisbane. You might be wondering how Nancy would have been missed in the searches that occurred if this is what happened. Code has proposed the idea that this alleged accident occurred on a road called Elephant Pass, an area that was not of focus in the searches, about 3.5 kilometers or 2.2 miles south of where Nancy was last seen. Tasman Highway turns inland through the St. Mary's Pass, St. Mary's and Elephant Pass, and then back to the coast. If Nancy took this route, specifically, if she rode her bike on Elephant Pass, we already talked about the dangers of the other road, but this looks far more dangerous to me. Based on looking at Elephant Pass on Google Street View, as well as reading about it, I say this for a few reasons. One, Elephant Pass is pretty windy. There are a lot of curves. So all it would take is for a driver to come around a curve at a high rate of speed for an accident to occur. Two, there are portions of Elephant Pass where there are rather steep, what I would call hills, where if Nancy were knocked off her bike, she could have been severely injured or even killed. Three, the road looks fairly narrow, leaving less space for both a motorist and a cyclist. And maybe it's not as narrow as it looks on Google Street View. Someone listening to this who has driven on Elephant Pass can correct me if I'm wrong, but to me it looked very narrow and just overall not like a place where someone should be riding their bike. There's also a lot of thick vegetation on the side of the road. So that could potentially conceal a body and a bike. And it's not that every point along Elephant Pass looks the same. I just noticed there were several points I was looking at where it seemed pretty dangerous to be driving and slightly more dangerous than the alternative route she could have taken, which would have kept her along Tasman Highway pretty much the entire time.
Yeah, we just paused and Sam showed me what Elephant Pass actually looks like. And yeah, I totally agree. Someone could have struck Nancy with a car. There's not a lot there. Well, there isn't any room for a bike to be on a shoulder or anything. The bike would have to be in the actual car traffic lane.
It hardly looked there was enough room for two cars. So yeah, definitely not enough room for a bike.
So I definitely think it's possible for a car to have struck Nancy and she went tumbling over the side, because it wasn't just like a flat area around the street. It was not a cliff, but it was a steep hill, not necessarily a drop off, but a steep hill that was on the border of the road. So if a car was traveling at a high speed around the bend and struck Nancy, then yeah, she could have probably gone a long way down that hill.
And it's not that every section of Elephant Pass has a hill on the side of it. There are some flatter portions of it, but it's still certainly conceivable that kind of at any point on Elephant Pass, she could have been at danger. But more specifically, if she were near any elevator, if she's on an elevated portion of it, then yes, it's not actually that hard to conceive how this could have played out.
And remind me again, did they or did they not do an extensive search surrounding Elephant Pass?
They did not. Their searching was more focused on Tasman Highway, where Nancy was last known to be. I believe there were small sections of Elephant Pass that were looked into, but no, nothing extensive. In 2011, 18 years after Nancy vanished, a man came forward to police and shared that around the time of Nancy's disappearance, he saw a damaged bike that matched the description of Nancy's bike about 50 kilometers or 31 miles south of Nancy's last known location. He saw this bike in a rubbish trench on the East Coast. This tip led police to excavate sections of the area in which this man remembered the bike to be, but the searches did not turn up a bike.
So this man that brought this forward, he saw the bike, or he thought he saw the bike 18 years ago. And 18 years later, he brings this forward and said, yeah, I think I saw a bike.
Yes.
That matched the description?
Yeah.
That is bizarre.
I know. I mean, it's incredible that this man would remember something like that so many years later.
I mean, is this case like still in the news? Are people still talking about it?
Well, that's actually what he said caused him to come forward, is he was reading recent news articles about Nancy's case, and that prompted him to finally come forward. And it just seems surprising. Like, I would even be amazed if someone remembered this from 3 years ago. So 18 years ago just feels especially surprising. And I don't know what reason he would have to make this up, but it is just shocking that he would remember something like this.
Yeah, I don't want to sound like a jerk, but maybe he wanted to be involved with the investigation. I don't know. It just seems crazy to somehow remember that you saw a bike 18 years ago and it ties into this investigation. Maybe he kept a journal and he wrote little things down like that.
And then he was like, reading through all his journal entries from 18 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. Like, maybe he wrote in his journal every day and wrote down, hey, I saw a bike on the road.
Yeah, I mean, sadly, there is always that possibility that people want to be involved in cases. And I don't think it always has to be nefarious. Maybe he is even misremembering, or like, he thought he saw that and he wants to be helpful, so he's coming forward. But yeah, there's just no way to know. And especially because nothing was found, we'll kind of never know the full story with this guy and why he came forward when he did and what he actually saw. Now, we need to talk about another unsolved Tasmanian mystery that I alluded to earlier, and that is the murder of Victoria Cafasso. I thought about covering her case in addition to Nancy's in this episode, but I really prefer to dedicate episodes to one specific person, unless, of course, there is undoubtedly a connection between the cases. So I will give you a summary of Victoria's case and its similarities to Nancy's, and then maybe sometime in the future, we can cover Victoria's murder in a standalone episode. In October 1995, 2.5 years after Nancy vanished, a 20-year-old Italian law student visited Tasmania while on an academic break.
Was she traveling alone?
Yes, she was traveling alone. She had a family member who lived in Tasmania, or at least who was there while she was visiting, but she arrived alone. On October 11th, Victoria's sixth day in Tasmania, she decided to visit Bomoris Beach alone. This is the same beach Nancy stopped at on the day she was last seen alive. Victoria used the same entrance to the beach as Nancy did on the day she vanished. Victoria was last seen shortly after 10 a.m. sunbathing on the beach. Now, this next part is rather gruesome, so if you don't want to hear any details about Victoria's murder, I would fast forward about 30 seconds. A resident who was walking her dog came upon Victoria's dead body at approximately 1:30 p.m. Victoria had been violently killed, having been stabbed dozens of times on various parts of her body, including her head and face. Her body was unclothed except for a swimsuit top that had been pushed up and was kind of around her neck. The woman who came upon Victoria's body noticed that she was on the water's edge, so it's possible that the killer put her in the water first in an attempt to dispose of her, and she came back to shore. Victoria also had significant bruising on her body from a blunt object. The autopsy did not show any signs of sexual assault. It's possible that her swimsuit top was pushed up during the murder. The swimsuit bottoms were never found, and the autopsy revealed that Victoria fought her killer, who would have been covered in blood after the murder. How could something so violent occur without any witnesses? Where did the person go after killing Victoria, and how are they unnoticed? There were a few items Victoria's missing from the scene. As I said, the swimsuit bottoms were one of the items, so it's been postulated that the killer kept several items of Victoria's for some reason. 9 years prior to her murder, there was a reported attempted rape on Beaumaris Beach. Then in 1994, the year between Nancy and Victoria's cases, there was another attempted rape in the area. There have been various reports of strange and suspicious men in the area, including several reports from women who said their underwear was being stolen from them, according to Beaumaris Beach Mystery, the book about this case. No one has ever been held accountable in any of these situations or these crimes, and although there have been various suspects in Victoria's murder, no one has been arrested. So how does this tie to Nancy's case? Well, there are some obvious similarities, such as the location. Nancy was seen on Beaumaris Beach on the day of her disappearance. Nancy and Victoria were both female tourists in their 20s. The 2003 coroner's inquest into Nancy's case outlines all of the similarities. They had both been in Tasmania for just several days. They both spoke English. They both stayed on the East Coast shortly before their murder or disappearance. They were above average build. They would have been recognized as non-locals. Both were last seen on a weekday early in the month, Victoria on October 11th and Nancy on March 12th. Both were last seen in the late morning / early afternoon, and both women were described as sensible. And it appeared there may have been that attempt of disposing of Victoria's body in the water. Had she been disposed of in that way and not come back to shore, she could have remained missing like Nancy. So what do you think? Some of those similarities feel more important than others, namely the location. the fact that they were tourists who were in their 20s. And then some of the similarities just don't feel that significant, such as the fact that they could both speak English. That seems doesn't seem as relevant.
I think the geographical location and the demographic of the women is the biggest part of this, right? And also the fact that they were both tourists. And couple that with the fact that there were two attempted rapes that were in the same general timeline, right? One was in 94, one was in 96. I think it's
86 and 94.
86 and 94. Yeah. Okay. So it appears like there is a commonality between all of these events, and it's that beach.
Yes. I mean, we know that Nancy left the beach.
She could have been followed.
Yes, that's true. Someone could have spotted her there, targeted her from there. But then what? They knock her off her bike? I just don't know. I mean, it could have played out any number of ways, but...
Yeah, they drive right in front of her bike and stop her and...
Yeah. I think what makes it so difficult is that we don't know what happened to Nancy. It's not like in Victoria's case where we know what happened to her. We don't know who did it, but we know how she died. We don't know how Nancy died. We don't even have a body. So it makes it really hard to compare.
I mean, it's hard to say without finding Nancy's body because we don't know where Nancy's body is.
Right. And the coroner, Peter Wilson, found that there was no firm evidence to connect the two cases, which certainly seems reasonable. As you just said, without knowing how Nancy died, it makes it significantly more challenging to connect her case to Victoria's case. But I think the timing being only 2.5 years apart and the other concerning incidents, I think that was considered as well, or at least in people in the community, they considered that. But I think beyond these similarities, murders were and are not common in this area. So it's natural to consider the possibility that Victoria's murder and Nancy's presumed death are linked. Retired Detective Bob Code certainly doesn't think the two cases are connected, as he contends that Nancy was accidentally killed by a motorist and it was an entirely independent event of Victoria's murder. The author of the book about these cases believes it to be, quote, almost delusional to not believe the cases are connected. But again, the way I see it is just without Nancy's body, we can't come to a conclusion either way. Maybe I would feel differently if I were local to this area. But I mean, I'm very interested in the phone calls from someone confessing to striking a motorist accidentally in the area at the time of Nancy's disappearance. I don't think those calls can be ignored, especially the first one to the solicitor, if he's remembering correctly and telling the truth, because that call came before anyone even knew she was missing. Over the years, tips have been provided to the police, which have prompted several searches, even as recently as 2023. Police received a tip that there were human remains seen around the mid-90s in an area of bushland on the East Coast, but that search did not lead to the recovery of a body or any evidence. Right around the same time of this search, Bob Code told the Examiner that a woman came forward to him and shared that her son confided in her that he was having trouble getting on with his life. He asked if she remembered Nancy's case. Quote, the woman explained that her son had said he had been a passenger with another man and they had been driving south along the back roads from Georgetown to Hobart. They were under the influence of drugs while driving when they had come around a corner and hit Nancy. They panicked. Nobody was about, so they put her body and all her property in the car and continued traveling south. They then buried Nancy, her bike, and her belongings in a shallow grave in bushland, end quote. So now we have a third confession. This one's the most detailed, and it's possible that, if true, this could be the same man who made the calls about the incident already, or if there were two people in the vehicle, they could have both called. I have to presume that Code shared this information with the Tasmania police, and surely they have the identity of this man, unless the woman would not reveal her son's identity.
I mean, couldn't this realistically been the same person with all of these confessions?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I think it could have been, or like I said, if there were two people in the car, could have been both of the people called at some point, or
yeah,
maybe the man who made the confession to his mom is different from the person who made the calls.
To the lawyer, yeah.
And to America's Most Wanted.
Right.
Or America's Most Wanted. Sorry, Australia's Most Wanted.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, at a certain point, it becomes hard to ignore all of these people who are saying they struck
someone
on a bike.
Yeah,
around the time Nancy disappeared. But then what do you do with it? I mean, it's promising that this information was as recent as 2023. This variation seems to differ slightly from the call that came from Australia's Most Wanted, because in that call, the person alluded to pushing her body down an embankment, whereas in this variation, he allegedly said they took Nancy's body with them. Code acknowledges that it might be difficult to understand how someone could do such a thing, but his experience has led him to believe that people can be capable of anything in a state of shock and panic.
And under the influence of drugs too, right?
Great point. Yes, that's a totally different factor that could exacerbate the feelings that they had and lead them to make a decision that they wouldn't make normally. Code believes the answers lie somewhere in Queensland, where he believes the caller is from, based on the second phone call to Queensland Crime Stoppers that came from a Brisbane number. And it could even be related to the woman who came forward to him as well. She could be living in that area. And you wonder, like, taking this 2023 incident out of the picture for a moment, just the voicemail to the solicitor and the call after the Australia's Most Wanted program, you kind of wonder why someone would do this, why they would call and confess. And I thought about it a lot in this case. And the only thing I can think of is that they wanted to get it off their chest without taking accountability. They wanted Nancy's family to have answers because they felt guilty, yet they didn't feel guilty enough to potentially have to be held accountable for their actions. I don't know. Can you think of any other reason why someone would call? It seems like it could be a hoax or a prank, or they could be referring to a totally different incident, but there were no other similar incidents at that time.
No, just that it continued to weigh on their conscience and they felt like they needed to tell someone.
And maybe they thought when they called and said this, that it would be over. Like Nancy's family or the police would be like, all right, this is what happened. We know what happened to Nancy, but without more details of exactly where this happened, or if they took her body and disposed of her somewhere else, where she was disposed of, or where that bike could be. The bike could still be, I mean, bikes are durable. The bike could still be out there somewhere. So without more details, how can they ever have complete answers? Besides the theories related to a motorist striking Nancy, the 2003 inquest outlined three other theories. The first being that Nancy met with foul play for a reason such as sexual assault or some sort of personal gain, and then her body and possessions were disposed of. Coroner Peter Wilson indicated that this possibility could not be discounted, but there was likely not a financial motive as her bank accounts were not touched again. But could they have stolen her cash? That's still a possibility. The other two scenarios involve death by misadventure, such as Nancy falling down a mine shaft or even drowning. Wilson indicated that it would be expected that Nancy's belongings would have been found if this were the case. He acknowledged the possibility that she died of misadventure and someone came along after the fact, meaning they took her belongings, and despite the widespread media coverage of Nancy's disappearance, they kept quiet. Our listener who sent us this case mentioned the possibility of Nancy dying by accident, such as falling to her death, and her body could have been eaten by Tasmanian devils in the area. And Tasmanian devils wouldn't attack a live human, but they would eat a decaying body. Point being, if any animal got to Nancy's body quickly, or wouldn't even have to be that quick, but in those weeks where no one knew she was missing, it could have hampered the search process that started many weeks after Nancy was last seen. So I think we've covered all of the possibilities of what could have happened to Nancy. I can't think of any other explanations for her disappearance.
Yeah, I think we have two, in my mind, two equal scenarios here. One being Elephant Pass, where she got hit by a car, which seemed very likely. It was not a, it's a very narrow road.
Yes, if she went on Elephant Pass.
Right, right. And the other would be an abduction. I mean, she was a woman traveling alone on a bike. I feel like it's maybe not likely, but it's possible that she could have gotten abducted, especially when you consider Victoria's case.
Yes, I think those two scenarios are the most likely. Again, we don't know if Victoria's case is connected to Nancy's. We may never know. I hope that's not the case. I really was glad to see that there was still information in Nancy's case being discussed as recently as last year. So I still think there's hope for sure. Nancy's family was devastated by the loss. Nancy was supposed to be having the trip of a lifetime. Nancy's younger sister shared with reporters how she often reflects on what her life would be like if Nancy were still here and how it would be so different. I think with having only one sibling, it was just Nancy and her sister. You know, her sister lost that person who could relate to her in a way that no one else can. They had the unique shared experience of their childhood, and to not only not have that person anymore, but to also not know where they are has been extremely painful. Nancy's sister visits Tasmania around the time of her anniversary each year, and she told the Examiner that it makes her feel closer to Nancy because she knows she's somewhere in Tasmania. Nancy's father died in 2005, but her remaining family absolutely still deserves answers. Whether this was an accident or murder, they deserve to know what happened. And I'm really glad our listener brought this case to our attention. I think it deserves more coverage because if there is someone responsible for Nancy's death who feels guilty about what they did, then the more people who are talking about her case, the more pressure that person should feel to come forward.
And it still sounds pretty active.
Yeah, it does. No one has forgotten. And I hope that person who was responsible for what happened to Nancy realizes that people still want answers. And people in the community deserve to know what happened as well. I mean, imagine living in this kind of small community, or the area around Beaumaris Beach is very small. I can't imagine what it was like to be a resident at that time. And then to have Victoria's murder follow so shortly, it had to be really unsettling. A $30,000 cash reward was established early on in the investigation in Nancy's case. And in 2021, Tasmania police announced a major increase in the reward for information that prompted an arrest to $500,000, which is clearly a significant increase. If you have information related to Nancy's case, please contact Crime Stoppers at 1-800-333-000. That is all for now, but thank you all for joining us today. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to the show, and we will be back next week with a new case. Bye.
Bye.
You're doing all the right things, like eating clean and staying active, but nearly all of us are still missing a key piece, minerals. Concentrace Daily Mineral Powder helps restore what your body's not getting, supporting mood, energy, immunity, and nervous system balance. It's made from ionic trace minerals your body actually absorbs and comes in three delicious flavors, blue raspberry, blue Hawaiian, and blue acai. Because your body can't make minerals and modern food and water don't supply enough, start with minerals. Start with Concentrace. Find it now at TraceMinerals.com.